Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. You might have noticed that the doomsday clock has been reset earlier this month to 100 seconds to midnight, midnight being the black hole of terrestrial existence. This ominous jolt toward organic nullity is the closest to midnight since the doomsday clock was first conceived by the people who built the first atomic bomb as a metaphor for global catastrophe from nuclear madness. The clock's original setting in 1947 was 7 minutes to midnight and has been set backward and forward 24 times since then. The farthest from midnight in 1991 at 17 minutes at the end of the Cold War and collapse of Soviet Russia, and now at 1 minute, 40 seconds, the closest. Since Hiroshima and Nagasaki 75 years ago in 1945, the original atomic scientists started publishing the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which has depicted the doomsday clock on every cover. I start today's program with a statement by the editors as to why they have moved the clock's hands so close to oblivion. And this is from the editor's note. Founded in 1945 by University of Chicago scientists who had helped develop the first atomic weapons in the Manhattan Project, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists created the Doomsday Clock 2 years later, using the imagery of apocalypse, midnight, and the contemporary idiom of nuclear explosion, countdown to zero, to convey threats to humanity and the planet. The decision to move or leave it in place, the minute hand of the Doomsday Clock, is made every year by the Bulletin Science and Security Board. The clock has become a universally recognized indicator of the world's vulnerability to catastrophe from nuclear weapons, climate change, and disruptive technologies in other domains. 2. Leaders and citizens of the world, RE, closer than ever. It is 100 seconds to midnight. Date, January 23rd, 2020, which was the date of my last program. Humanity continues to face two simultaneous existential dangers, nuclear war and climate change, that are compounded by a threat multiplier, cyber-enabled information warfare, that undercuts society's ability to respond. The international security situation is dire, not just because these threats exist, but because world leaders have allowed the international political infrastructure for managing them to erode. In the nuclear realm, national leaders have ended or undermined several major arms control treaties and negotiations during the last year, creating an environment conducive to a renewed nuclear arms race, to the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and to lowered barriers to nuclear war. Political conflicts regarding nuclear programs in Iran and North Korea remain unresolved and are, if anything, worsening. U.S.-Russia cooperation on arms control and disarmament is all but non-existent. Public awareness of the climate crisis grew over the course of 2019, largely because of mass protests by young people around the world. Just the same, governmental action on climate change still falls far short of meeting the challenge at hand. At United Nations climate meetings last year, national delegates made fine speeches but put forward few concrete plans to further limit the carbon dioxide emissions that are disrupting Earth's climate. This limited political response came during a year when the effects of man-made climate change were manifested by one of the warmest years on record, extensive wildfires, and quicker than expected melting of glacial ice. Continued corruption of the information ecosphere on which democracy and public decision-making depend has heightened the nuclear and climate threats. In the last year, many governments used cyber-enabled disinformation campaigns to sow distrust in institutions and among nations, undermining domestic and international efforts to foster peace and protect the planet. This situation, two major threats to human civilization, amplified by sophisticated technology-propelled propaganda, would be serious enough if leaders around the world were focused on managing the danger and reducing the risk of catastrophe. Instead, over the last 2 years, we have seen influential leaders denigrate and discard the most effective methods for addressing complex threats, international agreements with strong verification regimes in favor of their own narrow interests and domestic political gain. By undermining cooperative science and law-based approaches to managing this daunting threat and a new willingness of political leaders to reject the negotiations and institutions that can protect civilization over the long term, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Science, and Security Board moves the doomsday clock 20 seconds closer to midnight, closer to apocalypse than ever before. In so doing, board members are explicitly warning leaders and citizens around the world that the international security situation is now more dangerous than it has ever been, even at the height of the Cold War. Civilization-ending nuclear war, whether started by design, blunder, or simple miscommunication, is a genuine possibility. Climate change that could devastate the planet is undeniably happening. And for a variety of reasons that include a corrupted and manipulated media environment, democratic governments and other institutions that should be working to address these threats have failed to rise to the challenge. But given the inaction and in too many cases counterproductive actions of international leaders, the members of the Science and Security Board are compelled to declare a state of emergency that requires the immediate, focused, and unrelenting attention of the entire world. It is 100 seconds to midnight. The clock continues to tick. Immediate action is required. And that's a statement from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and why they moved the clock. And now, something I wrote. The human species is at an incandescent moment of its own creation and volition. Like the old legends and myths we are so fond of, we are at a climactic moment we must surmount, a life and death matter to be overcome and passed beyond before the planet suffers an immense tragedy. Since the beginning of the nuclear age 75 years ago, very few of us have been able to confront the horror that nuclear weapons represent. And because we prefer to ignore or deny the consequences of nuclear holocaust, we have generally allowed a free hand to those who ensure its probability. We cling to promises of our leaders that they serve the best interests of humanity and pray they are right about their decisions because we are confused and perplexed about what they are doing with the terrible power we have acceded to them. We have made ourselves like trusting children, horrified and hardened by parental abuse, but we feel there is no alternative. We permit our governments to keep secret from us the vital information necessary to preserve ourselves and our descendants. If we know, we might have to act and prefer instead to leave the unthinkable to its perpetrators. This is where we are now as we helplessly wait for the very real possibility of a nuclear war that will have direct and future consequences on civilization and humanity and planet Earth itself. No person or country has the right to terrorize the world for reasons of power or because of local squabbles. It is difficult to separate peace from its evil twin war, not unlike concentrating on yang without including yin. Peace and war are joined at the hip, human perceptions that have no parallel in nature, which, of course, is violent as well as simultaneously nonviolent, from weather to symbiosis between predator and prey. Somehow we inventors of war think we can have life without it, which we baptize as peace. Peace is defined as a period free from war, or more nervously, as a period between wars. People who have unconditionally advocated for peace are known as pacifists. Pacifists wish to live not only their own lives in peace, but for it to become the normal condition of humanity. Pacifists are sneered at in times of war and told to live in the real world, the human world, in which we have more than once, and quite recently in this intensifying period of a new Cold War, of abolishing treaties that contributed to the end of the original Cold War, that the destruction of humanity by nuclear weapons is a, quote, sound military option, unquote. Pacifists have been imprisoned, exiled, or executed for centuries when they raise the issue of eradicating war. Pacifism exudes an odor of weakness and appeasement, and pacifists have been ostracized as agents or dupes of enemies. Pacifists are themselves in conflict. The central, most agonizing question is whether some principles are worth the risk of annihilation. Human life and possibly all organic existence is conceivably so rare in the universe that its loss as a result of dispute over abstract principles peculiar to a point in time would be more intolerable than the loss of those principles, which, being human in origin, would as surely be evaporated in a Holocaust. What difference does it make to the dead, Mahatma Gandhi said, whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy name of liberty or democracy? And that was Gandhi. Solutions to warfare have been ambiguous, insipid, and often ridiculous. Most pacifists agree that the only end to warfare will be a world state of some form. But one-world theories range from a loose federation of states not unlike the United Nations or European Union, sans Brexit, most likely, with the exception that its laws would be binding, to naked utopias and rather otherworldly Edens, or more ominously, to Orwellian or Huxleyan nightmares of rigid monocratic authority and mind control, which would most likely include perpetual war. Whatever their disagreements and varied visions, pacifists usually look down the long road instead of being gripped by the frenzies of the moment, and they have grim prophecies of humanity's future if it continues to make war upon itself. Pacifists seem to hope we might at least elevate beyond war and self-induced apocalypse to a higher plane of thought and compassion before we blow ourselves out like an extinguished candle. Life betrays us. We must die. Nothing can save us. Not love, not good works, not ageless monuments, not wealth, power, or prayer. Our curse is to perceive our end, and to numb the terror, we empty our lives as readily as our bowels. It is the most enduring question. Why must I die? Each death is an end to the world. Elaborate constructions of life afterward persist in every culture. Yet for all of the rigorous hells and nirvanas, a more solid faith gives our scanty lives meaning, that the bloodlines will continue, that humanity will survive the smaller mortalities of its members, our children, their children, a future time. The faith has lately been shattered. The human race has brilliantly invented its own suicide. For the entirety of its future, humanity, its civilizations, and quite possibly all other life on its own planet are threatened with a Holocaust conceived by itself, a cremation of equals, or more mockingly absurd even, an equality of cremations, either or both through nuclear and or solar side. We have seen our world from space, a mote in God's eye. The same technical mastery that ecocides Earth and sends rockets to the stars is capable also of sending them on a shorter final journey of obliteration, which seems the more immediate specicide. Especially now, with hardly a minute and a half left on the doomsday clock, it is an act of faith that at any instant deadly missiles have not been launched from somewhere. On an ordinary day, we might look up and see spiky umbrella-like contrails of nuclear missiles, and all that was normal a few moments before vanishes forever. Humanity will either obliterate or save itself. An indication the species might be worth preserving will be its courage to try. A species' extinction might begin when increasing numbers of its members lose hope for themselves and their future, when they stop their inner clocks because they perceive life as hopeless or unbearable. Some lasting effect must be a result of this dystopian despair, a decline of spirit and will, and the cleverness indispensable for personal and collective survival. The human race is not unlike any other life form that has lived temporarily on Earth. Like its individual members whose lives operate on personal timelines without reprieve, despite the swarm collectively skirting oblivion en masse, the species species must eventually extinct. And like a person, it can defunct at any age or stage of development. The richness of its past, its dreams or schemes, its successes or failures, none of these is a case against death of any or all. The very evolved quality that compelled human primacy over nearly everything else on Earth, our ruthless and intelligent raptor voracity, is the major obstacle to our continued existence. We differ from extinct predecessors for the fact that we have perpetrated our threatened extinction. Our possibly flashy end will literally be a byproduct of our own industry, unless we are able to overcome our history and survive the ever greater odds against it, which would be quite a remarkable divergence from our predecessors, who were unable to prevent their doom. Obviously, we cannot uninvent nuclear weapons, nor erase from memory the scientific knowledge that took centuries to accumulate. That learning will most likely remain cognizant for as long as Homo sapiens is able to defy its own handicaps and dwells in the galaxy. If we are not smart enough to contain our nuclear goblin and repeal the worst effects of climate change, our ruined cities will be evidence that we once, briefly and foolishly, inhabited Earth. Ultimately, it is the great mass of ordinary people who will and must prevent world suicide. It must be done by everyone, beginning with each one. A majority begins with one. Each of us will certainly die, either privately or as part of the extinction of our species, if we do not arrest the dangers of nuclear and solar oblivion. There are good reasons we must each die. Primary among them to make room and leave a few resources for our descendants. What is different now is that we must step outside our small fears and immediate prejudices and help ensure a world for our inheritors. There is nothing more personally political than the wish of the human race to survive upon its home planet. There has never been a more personal or more universal struggle in our history. And that was something I wrote. And now, in addendum, a crystallization written by an old friend of mine, Michael Graham, Ground Zero. More brilliant than 1,000 noonday suns, the flash and racing inferno poured down from the sky, and in an instant, a countryside turned to ash. Little girls with delicate skin were cremated in pink dresses. Old men on park benches vanished. Gone also were the benches and the shade trees flared into burning forests. Shadows were burnt into the ground the instant bone and blood burned away. Seeds that had contained such promise were scorched to lifeless pits by a cosmic zephyr traveling at the speed of death. Love and hope in its way were disintegrated. The giants of war had flung their spears. With unyielding and pitiless menace, they had squeezed a formulas for horror out of Earth, then shaped laws around bombs that turned the simple atom into the destroyer of worlds. The bombs quickly became the intent of laws, and the laws became hopelessly snarled with the laws and bombs of enemies. The drift to the final war was inevitable because zero was done to prevent it. A shower of radiation particles fell gently like an invisible snow upon the charred land, covering the smoking rubbish piles that had been alive moments before. There was silence, a crazy kind of silence. And that was Ground Zero by Michael Graham, who used to live in Arch Cape and was its fire marshal there. He now, I think, lives in Gresham. He wrote Ground Zero for the North Coast Times-Eagle in 1980. And Kate Wolfe, now the sun has come to Earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death. And as a side note, yesterday, 56 years ago, on January 29, 1964, Stanley Kubrick's film, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, opened in American movie theaters. One of the most remarkable human beings born on planet Earth, Mohandas K. Gandhi, was assassinated on this date 72 years ago, January 30th, 1948. He was known universally as Mahatma, which means the great soul, a recognition for his basic integrity and vow of poverty, as well as for his central role in the liberation of India from 2 centuries of British colonial rule. His development of nonviolent protest as the political method of revolutionary resistance to imperial power not only made him world famous, but also the philosophical guru of civil rights and freedom movements all over the planet. He was also imprisoned for many years upon many occasions. His most famous weapon against tyranny, aside from nonviolent action, was fasting nearly unto death several times. Not only acclaimed leader of the independence of India, he also led campaigns for ending poverty, the liberation of women, the end of the caste system and so-called untouchability, and in particular, espoused and personally practiced mass civil disobedience, famously reactivated by Martin Luther King and the Black American Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. Gandhi forsake wealth and lived most of his life simply, making his own clothes, most recognizably a loincloth, eating a vegetarian diet, living in a village ashram. He was influenced by his studies of the Bhagavad Gita, the Christian Bible, and the writings of Thoreau, Ruskin, and Tolstoy, among others. A famous cartoon by Bill Mauldin showed Gandhi talking to MLK, who had been assassinated 20 years later in 1968. The caption read, "The odd thing about assassins, Dr. King, is that they think they've killed you." The British writer Somerset Maugham might have been writing about Gandhi when he described a main character in one of his novels as a person who, quote, "has found what every one of us wants and few of us gets. Goodness is, after all, the greatest force in the world, and he's got it." And George Orwell, generally critical of Gandhi, wrote following his assassination by a disgruntled religious fanatic that, "compared with the other leading political figures of our time, how clean a smell he has managed to leave behind." And I would like to read now a few things Gandhi said about nonviolence. "There is no halfway between truth and nonviolence on the one hand and untruth and violence on the other. We never may be strong enough to be entirely nonviolent in thought, word, and deed, but we must keep nonviolence as our goal and make steady progress towards it. The attainment of freedom, whether for a man, a nation, or the world, must be in exact proportion to the attainment of nonviolence by each. Nonviolence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being. The acquisition of the spirit of non-resistance is a matter of long training in self-denial and appreciation of the hidden forces within ourselves. It changes one's outlook on life. It is the greatest force because it is the highest expression of the soul. If one is to combat the fetish of force, it will only be by means totally different from those in vogue among the pure worshippers of brute force." It has been suggested by American friends that the atom bomb will bring in ahimsa, which is peace and nonviolence, as nothing else can. This is very like a man glutting himself with dainties to the point of nausea and turning away from them, only to return with redoubled zeal after the effect of nausea is well over. Precisely in the same manner will the world return to violence with renewed zeal after the effect of disgust is worn out. So far as I can see, the atomic bomb has deadened the finest feeling that has sustained mankind for ages. There used to be the so-called laws of war which made it tolerable. Now we know the naked truth. War knows no law except that of might. The atom bomb brought an empty victory to the Allied arms, but it resulted for the time being in destroying the soul of Japan. What has happened to the soul of the destroying nation is yet too early to see. Mankind has to get out of violence only through nonviolence. Hatred can be overcome only by love. Counter-hatred only increases the surface as well as the depth of hatred. I regard the employment of the atom bomb for the wholesale destruction of men, women, and children as the most diabolical use of science. Nonviolence is the only thing the atom bomb cannot destroy. Unless now the world adopts nonviolence, it will spell certain suicide for mankind. Nonviolent defense neither knows nor accepts defeat at any stage. Therefore, a nation or a group which has made nonviolence its final policy cannot be subjected to slavery, even by the atom bomb. It is not possible for a modern state based on force nonviolently to resist forces of disorder, whether external or internal. A man cannot serve God and mammon, nor be temperate and furious at the same time. A nonviolent state must be broad-based on the will of an intelligent people, well able to know its mind and act upon it. And this is Michael McCusker.